about 30 people at this session, so there's a few more coming. But the way we're going to run it, we've got 75 minutes all together, but this is very much about your toughest apologetics questions. And so we're wanting you to provide the questions that you would like our panel of experts to attempt to answer. And as you came in the room, you would have been given an evaluation form to fill in at the end, but also a small card on which we'd like you to write down your tough apologetics questions. We're going to give you 5 minutes to do that, and then we'll collect them up, and they will provide the basis for our discussion. Okay, so we should have about just over an hour altogether of panel discussion. So we're not going to take questions from the floor. They will come through me as the chair, but you have the chance to write them down. So we'd like to do that now. By way of introduction, my name is Peter Saunders. I'm the Chief Executive of Christian Medical Fellowship, and I've just drawn the short straw of refereeing today amongst our panel of experts. They've been instructed that they don't have to agree with each other about everything. They've also been told they don't have to answer every question themselves, and they cover a range of different areas of expertise. There'll be some that they feel much more is their area. But just as you're filling out your cards, I'll just ask the panelists to introduce themselves and say a little bit about what they're doing in apologetics, and also perhaps a little testimony about how the Lord brought you into the whole area of apologetics in the first place. So, can we start soon?
So I'm Stefan Gustafsson from Stockholm, Sweden, or originally I'm from the very south of Sweden. So when I speak Swedish, I have an even more peculiar accent than I have now. I go through the Swedish IKS movement, the Swedish student movement, and I've done that for 5 years. So I've been involved a lot in high school ministry and in student work, student evangelism. I lead a study center in Stockholm, Kero Academy, where we train Christians in apologetics and persuasive evangelism, as well as, of course, in discipleship and helping people to grow in the personal walk with the Lord. I'm also General Secretary of the Swedish Evangelical Alliance. I come from a Christian background, a very warm Christian family, and as a young boy, I happily accepted Christ and became a Christian. But very early on also, I felt a tension between the belief of my family and the rest of my culture. Sweden is, of course, a very secular culture with a few Christians. And gradually, growing up, I felt more and more like an alien. No other in my class was a Christian. No other, to my knowledge, on the whole school was a Christian. I'm sure there were some Christians, but I didn't know. Okay. And for me personally, the truth issues became very important. What is this that is so important in my family to become important for me? But what is it? Why is no one else caring about God and Jesus and the Bible? In God's grace, I came in contact with different people. I came in contact with the books of Francis Schaeffer. And in my personal walk, apologetics became very important in helping me to see the kind of factual ground for the Christian faith. And then later on, I've been involved in evangelism during many years. And to do evangelism in Sweden, you are forced to relate also to intellectual questions and the whole truth issue. And I found that apologetics very helpful and very important in our evangelism. I'm very much involved in the local church, and I see the need for helping Christians to understand their own faith. So we try to integrate in my local church apologetics with the preaching and the regular teaching. Okay, so my background.
And over to Bruce. For those who are coming a little late, what we're doing, we're just introducing the speakers, but we're wanting you to write down your questions, which are going to be collected up very shortly to provide a basis of discussion.
And Bruce Little, from presently from North Carolina in the States, where I teach in a relatively large evangelical seminary. I teach in the area of broadly philosophy, apologetics, and as well as the areas of Christianity and culture. I was a pastor for some 30 years and struggled with, even as a pastor, struggled with some of the issues and the questions that were being brought to me, and I really didn't have answers because, and not as a criticism, I'm grateful for the people who were instrumental in my coming to Christ, but I was saved in the New England area, and we were simply told that it was not necessary to have answers for your questions. If you had enough faith, that's all that was really required. And I was so tired of hearing that. But yet I thought that must be the spiritual way to go, because that's what everybody was saying. And then I read Francis Schaeffer, and he says that I did not have to check my mind at the door, that I did not have to stop asking questions, and there were answers. They should be questions, but there were answers. And I was a late comer to the academic world. I did not start my college, my BA, until I was 34 years old. So I would work twice as hard to be half as good, and hardly do I qualify to be an expert. Just kind of do the best I can with what I've got. And I am also the president of the Forum for Christian Thought, where I travel in many places in the country, particularly in Eastern Europe, where I've been lecturing in universities for some 20 years, as well as conducting apologetic workshops and teaching in seminaries in different places. I'm also the director of the Francis Schaeffer Collection, which doesn't really mean a whole lot. I just like to say it because he had an influence in my life, so that I have that connection. And so that's the other notable fact about me is that I was born on the same day, same year as Adolf Hitler committed suicide.
So I'm Peter S. Williams, to be distinguished from Peter J. Williams. You can also meet at this conference, and indeed who I have a joint session with later, so you'll be able to tell us apart after that if you come to that. As you can see, I'm not so little, although I have recently taken up swimming, so I'm becoming slightly smaller. I was brought up in a Christian home by parents who were trained in the sciences, so they were science teachers. And would discuss issues of the sermon over Sunday lunch, and would watch science documentaries, and had on the bookshelf a number of books on sort of issues to do with science and Christianity, a number of the works of the essays of C.S. Lewis and so on. So from a fairly early age, I was sort of brought up in an environment that was conducive to the importance of thinking about questions of truth. Parents who encouraged me to make my own mind up on this religion business and said, you know, I had to come to choose to adopt or not adopt it for myself, not just because they happened to go to church, and that it was up to me to, you know, choose a denomination or choose a religion or not, and that they would love me and support me, whatever I did with that. So they gave me a great deal of freedom, but also a great deal of support and kind of thinking that through, as it were, and introducing me, particularly at an early age, to the works of C.S. Lewis, first with the Narnia Chronicles and then through graduating onto his apologetical works. So then I discovered philosophy as a subject. First of all, a little bit at sixth form, where I studied classical civilizations, but particularly when I went on to university for the first time, discovered philosophy as a subject and fell in love with it, and was also working at student evangelism and things, and being part of student group committees in chaplaincy groups and so on at universities as I went through, and seeing immediately that the relevance of philosophical training to evangelism, and I guess I've kind of specialised in the conversation between Christianity as a worldview and people coming from a naturalistic, materialistic perspective. So I specialised in arguments for the existence of God, arguments against naturalism as a worldview, the interrelationship between science and Christianity. All of those are kind of areas that I'm particularly interested in philosophically. And then I've broadened out as well into the important sort of Jesus-centric New Testament sort of apologetic issues, and have written a number of books, and particularly sort of engaging with the recent rise of the new atheism in the Anglo-American world particularly. So those are sort of my areas of speciality. And a lot of Christians will sympathise and even empathise with this as a question. So I think that there's an importance in sort of affirming the reality and the importance of the question, and saying that we are not, living a life with rose-coloured glasses on that isn't alive to the reality of the problem of evil. But I would want to move on to saying there's something a little sort of odd about the way that he's phrased the objection, really, because most people would think of the problem of evil as an objection to the existence of God. And yet he's phrased it as a way of confronting God. The way he's phrased it assumes that there is a God behind the world, and that he could meet that God and then denounce that God for failing to live up to some sort of moral standard of how things should be if that God was doing his job properly, as it were. So rather than using it as an argument to say there isn't a God with whom I could be angry because of the existence of evil, he's wanting there to be a God with whom he can be angry at in the name of evil. And I think that just evinces a misunderstanding of the nature of what it is for there to be a God. And within the Christian view, where God is not just a tyrant imposing a set of arbitrary rules and moral constraints upon us, whereby he wants us to live by them, and if we don't toe the line, then he punishes us and sends us to hell, sort of thing. That God has an eternal and essential character, which is, if you like, the plumb line of goodness, the standard of goodness. and that you need to be able to invoke such a thing, an objective standard of goodness, when you say this or that reality is falling short of the ideal of goodness. Christianity, at least, gives you a worldview in which there is such a standard that makes sense of the question, that makes sense of our revulsion at certain evils and instances of suffering. Whereas I would say a naturalistic worldview that just says, well, all there is just matter. As you know, Richard Dawkins described that materialistic worldview by saying, there is no design, no purpose, no creator, in other words, behind the world. There is just pitiless indifference. But a universe of pitiless indifference doesn't give you any solid ground to stand upon when you want to rail against evil and suffering in the world. So I would want to turn the discussion to affirming the question, but pointing out what the preconditions of even being able to ask that question are, and how that actually points at least towards something like a theistic worldview, and certainly points away from a naturalistic worldview.
Okay, so there are assumptions behind the question. I guess at its simplest level, the problem of evil could be framed like this. Christians believe in a God who is all-powerful, all-knowing, and completely benevolent. So if he's all-knowing, he must know about evil and suffering. If he's all-powerful, he must be able to do something about it. And if he's benevolent, he would surely want to. So why doesn't he, particularly in areas where, like bone cancer in children, where it doesn't seem like there was any other agency involved? And I suppose the atheist would either come to the conclusion that such a God cannot possibly exist, or alternatively, that if the God of the Bible does exist, that allows this, he's so fundamentally unjust that one would not want to put their faith in him anyway. So, do you want to come back to that, Stefan? I can see you feeling a strong compulsion to speak on this easy question.
I think it's important to affirm the horror of the situation and not give a shallow or just to bypass the horror and the pain and the reality of evil we are discussing. But then, of course, we need to also see what kind of resources we have within the Christian worldview to address this issue. One resource, one perspective is, of course, that we look backwards in history and say, are we really sure there is this simple, direct relationship between God and what we see? Couldn't there be other factors that we need to be taken into account, not denying that God is all-powerful or almighty? And, of course, in the Christian worldview, there is the fall, revolt against God. There are evil powers in the world. It's not in a perfect state, but something has happened that has destroyed the world. And then another resource is, of course, that we look forward in history. Always when deciding to judge a person, and the question implies that we're judging God, not saying he's not living up to being God. You need to choose a point along history. Where is the right point to judge God and say, you are not fair? And we as Christians would say, well, there are a lot of situations within the world now which is deeply unjust and unfair. But we hold on our judgment until the end of history to see where God is leading everything. And that's the right point to make the final judgment about God, in God's character, and how God has dealt with every individual when we see how the story ends. And we are convinced that making the judgment on that day, everyone will confess that God, of course, is there, and that he's holy, and that he is good, and then we will complain about the moral character of God when we see how the story finishes. And we, of course, bears this conviction out from Jesus, and what we have seen of God's dealing with evil in Jesus Christ. So we said this gives us confidence that on the final day we will be able to say He is real, but all will be good.
Okay, so the spiritual agencies, evil spiritual agencies who are doing bad things, yes, there are. We're not in a position to be able to judge God because we don't see the big picture. We've got to see it in the light of the future and what God's going to do. And we learn about God's own character and reaction to people in suffering by looking at the way that Jesus himself annihilated suffering in others and took suffering upon himself. Bruce, anything else in this area?
Well, I agree with both of the gentlemen, but I still think that if I'm an atheist, I'd push back at certain points.
Yeah.
And for example, certainly Stefan is right that we have angels, we have other issues that are created, but then the question is that is God responsible for all that is? And that just seems to kick the can down the road a little bit further.
Yeah, so how are you going to respond to the question you just asked?
I am going to respond to it in that something has to find it, but build it bigger. If I am being asked a question about my God, then I have a right to give the larger narrative and starting at creation. And I have the right to talk about libertarian freedom. I have the right to talk about the fall and why things are corrupted. So I know it's not a short answer. I'll make it short, but it's not a short answer. Some of these answers we give are very good rhetorical questions, and they will silence the questioner for the moment, but they will be pressed upon further, and we need to be ready. So I think we need a larger narrative, I would call it, as it has been called, a theodicy, that allows us to understand how God can be all we claim Him to be, and yet His presence in affairs in His world be as it is. And I think that can be done. I've written several books on it, debated the issue, and
are there any elements of the Christian theodicy that haven't been raised yet that we want to look?
Well, the one that I would make is, I believe it is possible to, if gratuitous evil exists, he would not come against the moral perfections of God. And once we can do that, and I think we can, then you see, we no longer have to give some of the answers that we have traditionally been given. God allowed it because he's going to bring some greater good out of it or something like that. If we can do this, if gratuitous evil exists, that is pointless, I'm not saying all evil, I'm just saying if it exists, I don't have to identify it. I just have to affirm the possibility, if it does exist, that I can affirm also that God's moral perfections have not been contaminated at all.
Okay, I guess the new atheists at this point would go deeper and they'd say, well, the Bible seems to suggest that there are elements of evil and suffering that are directly caused by God. So, for example, and we all know that she's talking about a homophobic, pestilential, genocidal, megalomaniac, and however many more adjectives to add to it. But I mean, specifically, how could a God of love command stoning, cutting off of people's hands, killing babies? I suppose we're coming on to the slaughter of the Canaanites and the Amalekites, because there seems to be, as Dawkins would say, the pestilential God sending plagues, not just on the Egyptians, but on his own beloved people of Israel, where the Bible strongly affirms that God is actually the agent causing this evil and suffering. And we can react to this at an intellectual level, but these feelings of revulsion are very deeply felt by people, especially who've been the victims, if you like, of these sorts of sufferings themselves. So how do we address the issue of evil and suffering, which it seems the Bible asserts God is the direct cause of. It's enough just to say that we love him and trust him.
At the risk of seeming like I'm dodging the question, I'm sure we could come back to it, but again, I think it's an important point about thinking about the presuppositions of questions that one is being asked. And I find this time and time again in schools when I'm in there with sixth form students, getting them thinking about the existence of God and so on. They very often go to arguments that are biblically based, and they will say things like, you know, if you believe in the Bible, you have to believe in young earth creationism, and evolution is true, and therefore there's no God, or something like this. And I point out to them that even if they were right about that, even if they were right about how you had to interpret the Bible, even if they were right about evolution being true, that that's not an argument against God, that's an argument against a particular revelation claim. It's an argument against biblical infallibility, maybe. But it's not necessarily an argument against Christianity, and it's certainly not an argument against believing in God. So at what stage do you want to conflate the discussion of the sort of generic issue, is it reasonable to believe in a God, with the more particular issue of is it reasonable to believe in my particular religious perspective on who that God is and what he's done in history? Because people can kind of try and sidestep the crucial issue of is there a God, just by focusing on these specific sort of biblically based things. The time to address that issue, really, I think, is when someone has got to the stage of saying, okay, I'm open to there being a God. What I'm really asking now is, should I be a Christian or should I be a Muslim? Or should I, you know, just be a philosophical theist or what have you? And that's when we do need to address these particular biblical sort of objections. But I think it's really important to point out to people that even if they thought they had a really good, you know, I can't believe in a God who commands the slaughter of the Canaanites or whatever, well, that's not the same thing as them having a good reason for being a naturalist or for not believing in a God.
I think behind the question is also the thought that God is on the same level as us, and we evaluate him the way we would evaluate each other, which is, of course, a huge mistake. God is really there. He is his own category, and we are his creatures. And I think we need to point out several things. For example, the goodness of a just judgment. So, for example, if I kidnap you and lock you into a room, that's something very evil, an evil deed, and I should be condemned. If you have done an evil deed and are thrown into prison, the specific act is identical to what I did to you and what the state is doing to you. But in the second example, it's a good act, because it's the just judgment over an evil deed you did, even though you're still in prison. So there's a difference what I'm doing to you and what the state is doing to you, and if there is a moral reason behind the state doing this to you. And of course, this goes even more if there is a God. Actually, I start to think about it. If there is a God who has created me and given me life, he actually has the right to take my life. I'm saying that's a pleasant thought, but I realize that's kind of God's prerogatives, if he's God. And I also realize if he takes me my life, he can do something further on in history with me, which I can if I take your life. Now, the whole picture in the Old Testament is that God judges evil nations and evil individuals, and that it is a moral judgment coming, and that God is not immoral, but he is just when he's doing it. Most of the time he's withholding his judgment, showing mercy where he could justly have shown punishment. But in some instances, the punishment is coming. So I think there's a lot of things to be discussed in terms of who is, if there is a God, what's our relationship and state for God.
Just to move that on a bit, to our next question here, but it's on a similar theme, and it's really about the justice and fairness of hell. So one might ask, why doesn't God just exterminate and annihilate those who rebel? Why does he have to go on punishing them for all eternity? Isn't that a bit over the top? Maybe you want to come back on that.
Sure, so I'm an annihilationist, so I think he exactly does do that, and I'm very pleased for my colleagues here to agree or disagree, but there certainly are Christian theologians who will argue the case for interpreting the biblical language about hell as exactly God doing that, of God expunging evil finally from existence. There is, of course, a long church history of taking that language in terms of a literal sort of eternal punishment as well. But it's certainly a theological debate to be gone into on that. I don't think it's a knockdown kind of issue. It's one of those issues where there are different Christian views, and it's worth getting hold of a debate book between different theologians who hold those different interpretations and reading it through and seeing who you think makes the best case and the best way to interpret the biblical language as well.
Any non-annihilationists on the
panel? Bruce? I would like to see, of course, there are a lot of things I would like to see. There are some hard sayings in the Bible, but at any rate, I think that maybe some of the difficulty that comes with hell is how we present it. There are so many different, even seemingly contrary, images of what hell is. For example, it's out of darkness, and yet there's fire there. So how do you get darkness? So what if hell is simply people living out precisely what they chose, to live a life, an environment, a state of affairs where there is no God, where there's total absence of truth, total absence of life, morally, spiritually. So I'm wondering, I have not yet been able to bring myself to an nihilist position, though I understand some of the arguments and they're somewhat inviting to me, but at this point, the best way I have to hold on to my theological position is to say pretty much what I just said. I just think we like that some preachers like very much to get very red in the face and do a lot of screaming and make you feel the fire. Maybe I'm wrong about this, but I'm not sure that there's any kind of literal fire there. It may just be that men and women get what they, I think this is somewhat Lewis would have said, they just simply get what they said they wanted.
Yeah, so as Lewis would say, there's some people who say to God, "Thy will be done," and there are other people to whom God says, "Thy will be done."
And I think people who take the biblical imagery in those different ways can both agree on that point. It's then a disagreement over the duration of what happens to people, rather than why it is that it happens to them. Again, it's not an arbitrary punishment for sin. It's not like being fined because you parked the car on the double yellow lines, and it's like I get given an arbitrary punishment from the government because of doing that. It's more like reaping the result of what I sow. If I keep drinking pint after pint after pint, and then I have an accident because I'm drunk, that's not an arbitrary punishment for getting drunk. That's reaping what I sow.
I think the different sides on this issue are in basic agreement that there will be a judgment and there will be a righteous punishment. And if that punishment is then eternal, then I think that partly behind the question is, how could a limited amount of sin deserve unlimited punishment? And I think inbuilt into the traditional position is that if you exist consciously for eternity and you have opposed God in this life, you will continue to oppose God. And your rebellion will be an ongoing rebellion and will therefore be an eternal rebellion. In some revival preaching, in order to stir people to make a choice for Christ, they have depicted the lost as someone who suddenly realizes, oh, I did the wrong thing. I really long to be with God, but now it's too late. Mm. I do not think the Bible gives that picture. Mm. But your rebellion is confirmed and fatherless, and you really get what you yourself want. You do not want to be with God. Mm. And it's not God in his hardness locking you out, but it is your responsibility that you are there, and you continue to oppose God. And in that sense, therefore, it's not an unjust judgment, even though it should go on for eternity.
Okay, let's move on. Another question, perhaps, about the justice of God. I'm just wanting to cover a bit wider areas, but it comes back to the center of the themes. What happens to those who have never heard the gospel? Bruce, do you want to take this?
Well, I think the assumption that they've never heard. If we read Romans chapter 10, Paul actually quotes, and Isaiah says, well, maybe the reason people have responded is because they haven't heard. Paul comes back and quotes Psalm 19, and say they have heard, that the line has gone out. Now, I think that I have a fairly strong view on natural revelation, natural theology. I think there's sufficient information in nature and the way man is constructed, that is, in terms of his mental capabilities and big structures, that there's sufficient information to know that there is a law. That is, granted, that's not for salvation, but then what if one is, so to speak, positive at saying, yes, there is this kind of God, I don't know much about it, but there is this kind of God. Would God then get that individual the gospel message? Well, I think he would. I see Paul, Peter, who takes the message up to the man in Caesarea. I see Philip, who's taken down to the Negev and gives the gospel to the eunuch. But is it possible? Is it possible that there is a man, woman, out in the bush, and nobody's going to go with a human voice? Is it possible that God could get the gospel information to them without a human voice? I have of late been willing to entertain that idea. I don't think it's outside the scope of orthodoxy at all. That doesn't minimize my responsibility to go. I am commanded to go. But so I couldn't say, oh, well, I don't go again, so I'll bear my own responsibility for not going. So I challenge the assumption that people that they have never heard.
So there's a sense in which every human being is responsible, every human being is guilty, every human being has been shown some light, and that we're judged on the basis of the light that we have seen. And I guess that's the meaning of Romans, isn't it, that God speaks not just through his revelation to Jewish people, but also through conscience and through nature itself. Shall we move on to origins now? We can't escape this. But should we defend a literal seven-day creation story, and I guess going with young Earth, or should we agree with the intelligent creator plus evolution, in other words, theistic evolution, or perhaps should it be something in between the two, old Earth creations and whatever? And does it really matter? So this is the first question.
Yeah.
And I think maybe a follow-up to that would be good to know from our panelists how they deal with this question. in an apologetic arena, knowing that in fact there'll be Christians in the audience who take different views on it. So we'd like to kick off with that one.
Yeah, sure. I think that's an excellent point. And I think it's really important in evangelism and apologetics to distinguish between those issues that are key issues, that are central issues, that are kind of mere Christianity issues, if you like, whereby if someone doesn't hold a certain view, then it's not possible for them to become a Christian. from those issues that are secondary or tertiary and so on. And so I would very clearly distinguish for people the difference between the need to accept the doctrine of creation, the idea that there is a God who created everything apart from himself, that there is therefore a meaning and purpose to the universe, that people are created in his image and morally responsible for, before him, and sinners and need him and so on. That all comes out of the doctrine of creation. But to point out that Christians, on top of holding in common the doctrine of creation, hold different theoretical models of how we understand what the biblical literature about creation says. We hold different models of what scientific investigation of the world tells us, and we hold different models of how to integrate those two sources of knowledge into a synoptic worldview of this issue. And that it's obviously a very complex question that equally informed and genuine Christians disagree about. And it's fine for them to disagree about it as long as they don't do that disagreeably with one another. But that you don't have to accept my view on the interpretation of Genesis 1 and 2, or my view on whether or not evolution is a sufficient or more or less insufficient scientific theory, in order to become a Christian. To do that, you need to believe in God and that he created us, and you need to believe in Christ, and so on. And maybe the time to sort out what you think about that really complex issue of biblical interpretation and science and the philosophy of science and all that is kind of downstream from working out what you think about those central issues. So again, I would try and not get, in an apologetics context, sidetracked into an issue that's not the main issue.
The question is raised. We have, of course, talking about ELF, been forced to answer that question, starting a science network. And it has been very important for us that the science network is open for young Earth creationists, old Earth creationists, theistic evolutionists, and all different versions of intelligent design. So we don't take a stand in terms of speakers and participants from this issue, and we want to hold it open. And it's very much an in-house discussion amongst Christians. What's the best way to synthesize our interpretation of the Bible with what we think we know about the universe? And we all agree that in the end there will be coherence about the facts of the universe and the true meaning of the text of the Bible. But along the way, of course, there will be discussion: have we found the truth about the universe, and are we on the right track in how to understand the first three chapters, or the first 11 chapters of Genesis? We need to show some grace and some openness in terms of dialogue and debate with each other on those issues. In terms of evangelism, and if I think about Sweden, I think it's extremely important not to bring in those issues there. The big issue is, of course, if the universe is self-explanatory and it's there because of itself, or if there is a creator in mind that has caused the universe into existence, the whole issue of the culture is there. Now, if you then come to believe in the creator God, then the interpretation of Genesis becomes an important and interesting and challenging issue. Mm. But in terms of the values, I think we should stick to the big issue. Mm.
Bruce? Yes, I agree primarily with what Tim has said. I don't think it's an issue that we get into with apologetics, but there are two issues. One is soteriological. should that ever be a standard for salvation? And as Pete has pointed out, it's absolutely not. However, as Stefan is saying, once we become a Christian, it does become an issue, because it's an interpretive issue, if we do hold to certain views of the Bible, for our instruction, and it has truth to claim, so when it speaks to these matters, then it is important. And I think some of us, or all of us, probably need to find where we think that level is. It must be defended. And I'm not suggesting everybody would put it in the same place. We have good friends, and we have whole ministries who would see creating a man, the demonoid, and then gets the Spirit of God, and that's too low for me. I still want to hold to a historic Adam created by God, by word, and then the banana, the building of the body in Genesis 2. But those levels can be, and that's what Paul intended to do, and as Stefan said, those are in-house issues. And I think we've made a tragic mistake in making them the public debate out there, to begin to confuse the issue.
We've got a question just on the historicity of Adam here, and it's really pointing out that the historicity of Adam, it could be argued, has consequences for soteriology as well. So the way it's been put here is, how would we answer Jerry Coyne's charge, Jerry Coyne being an evolutionist, against redemption, which goes something like this. If Adam and Eve are of death, so not historical, then there's no original sin. If there's no original sin, then Christ died for men. How do we respond to that? Paul talks about the first Adam and so on.
And I think here is a confusion if one thinks that an acceptance of evolution by itself denies this world of Adam and Eve. There is no necessity for saying that. You can, of course, imagine that God is using all the evolutionary processes that the dominant theory today describes. And then when hominids have developed to a certain state, God chooses two individuals and make them into his image. And the human race, in terms of Imago Dei, starts with those two, or with two being representatives of a small group or something. There is a number of scenarios you can still think of where Adam and Eve are real persons living in relationship with God and then rebelling against God. In my view, it's very clear in the Bible that Adam and Eve is viewed as historical individuals, linked to other historical individuals that we know of, and of course compared to Jesus Christ as an historical individual. So for me, the historicity there is very important, but I don't see a necessary denial of historicity if you accept evolution.
Yeah.
Yes, but when I was a student, it was always far more simply, who was Cain's wife? Peter?
Yeah, I mean, there are certainly, I think one can argue there are indications within the text itself for perhaps coming to a view that I've myself been coming to more recently of thinking that it's possible, for example, to believe in a historical Adam and Eve without thinking that Adam and Eve are literally the first human beings. And I've been reading a number of Christians who sort of have said that as well. So there's the sort of range of possible interpretations is actually much more fine-grained when you start delving into the area than the public conversation often recognises. It people want to just put you into a sort of either-or bind between a sort of literal young earth creationist, Adam and Eve, the first people interpretation, or you're sort of just taking it mythologically. And actually there are a range of fine-grained views to consider carefully in between those. And on top of what Stefan said, it would also be worth pointing out to people the fact that, you know, Paul, in talking about Christ and Adam and comparing them, talks in very typological terms and draws a comparison between being in Christ and being in Adam and death and spread to everyone because everyone sinned, that we are in Adam typologically, and talks about Adam as the first man, but then he also talks about Jesus as the second man. Now, Jesus is not historically, literally speaking, the second human being. So perhaps he means the first type of man and the second type of man, the fallen man and the redeemed, you know, the restored man, and so on, with fallen in Adam and restored in Christ.
I drew my line in a different place, and I admit that there are other possibilities. One of the concerns that comes more philosophical than theological to me is that I do happen to be an essentialist. And I think, as Richard Dawkins says, if essentialism is right, evolution has lost its ground. And maybe I'm wrong on being an essentialist, okay?
Do you want to just unpack for us what an essentialist is? Because not everybody
knows. I'm sorry. Or we could just avoid it and say he's a crazy old man.
Another word to end.
Okay. An essentialist is one who believes that an entity is what it is by its essence. And that is, we are human beings because we have the essence of humanness. And of course, it has a forceness or some form of that. And so, they don't seem to transmigrate. In other words, you can't seem to create essences. You can create species within natural kinds, but essence determines natural kind, species where evolution takes place, which I would say. And I'm not a scientist, but I'm trying to bring my theology and my philosophy together.
So how would that relate to the question of the story?
Well, if you were going to say that at the moment that God breathes the breath of life, is that what you would say? We could say then that essentialism would still work on those grounds.
Well, a lot of the questions we've had so far come from those who perhaps have an atheist worldview. If we can move to theists with contrary worldviews. One of the big questions that comes up in Islamic evangelism in particular is the question of Trinity. And it's also, there have been times in the Christian history too when there have been Unitarians who can't come to the Trinity. So here's the question that's simple as all: how can God be both one and three? I'd like to start up.
Well, he cannot be one and three in the same respect. We don't believe in one God, three gods simultaneously. But we believe in one God, one divine essence, and then three persons. And it's of course possible to believe one God existed in three persons, because a God and a person is not the same concept. So there is no logical contradiction. This does not, of course, help us to exhaust the Trinity, but it helps us to see that there is no inherent logical contradiction in the Christian, at the heart of the Christian theology. For me, the best way to see the contrast between Muslim theology and Christian theology here is to take the Muslim concept of unity of Allah, and say, okay, let's run with that. There's one God and he's an absolute unity in his own essence. Before the creation of the world, what was the defining aspect of Allah? Well, at least one of them must be loneliness. He's absolutely unrelated and lonely. And if there is love in Allah, it's only as a potential, not as an actuality. It's not a reality. He could, of course, create something outside of himself and start to relate to and maybe love. So the potential becomes actuality. The picture of God in the Bible is totally different. as Schaeffer, Franz Schaeffer often pointed out, Jesus prayed in John 17 to the Father, saying, "You have loved me from all eternity, even before the creation of the world." So, if we take the Christian concept of a God who is relationship, who is a social God, and we run with that, and we go back in time before the creation of the world, we have a dynamic God of love and communication and commitment and real relationship with God. And God is not creating us because He needs us, but because He wants to invite us to the love that is already a reality within God. So in Christianity you can really say God is love, not potentially if He creates something outside Himself, but He is love within His own being because there are three persons who love each other in the one God.
Yeah, absolutely, and you can then link that back to the previous question we had as well, because that then links into the Christian notion of humanity and society and so on. If we're created in the image of a God who is intrinsically social and creates male and female in His image jointly to reflect the image of God, as an individual, a male or a female reflects the image of God, but there's something I think indicated about male and female together, and then following on from the union of male and female into family, that is also reflecting the heart of reality in the essence of God. And so there are sort of moral messages coming through that creation in the image of God story that link with the doctrine of Trinity that you don't get with a sort of Islamic strict monotheistic view of reality.
Okay. Shifting now to the Bible. It's certainly true that the Bible has come under a fresh attack from the New Atheists, although perhaps it began really in earnest in the early 19th century, or perhaps even earlier. But here's the question that's framed by this person. Why should one believe a book which is a collection of loosely connected, geographically very narrow literature that even Christians cannot agree on? Bruce.
Well, I should believe it because my preacher said I should believe it. Well, that's a good question indeed. But I would answer it in this way. I would answer it saying that I am within my epistemic rights to claim that I am a word from God, and then to go on and to demonstrate without using the Bible that is the grounding by which I make the claim. It's not a circuitous argument. I don't quote the Bible when it says that all scriptures God breathed. It says, okay, now that does it, because that's very circular, isn't it? But Jesus, in John chapter, in Mark chapter 9, Jesus says that, and I'll just put it all together, He says that the Old Testament, the law, is the Word of God. Jesus said that. All I'm arguing for is the Word of God. Okay? And then Jesus also said, when in John chapter 10, when He was confronted with being for blasphemy, calling himself God, He quotes the book of Psalms, Psalm 86, and He says, you know, in defense of him calling himself God, and then He says, oh, and by the way, the scriptures cannot be broken, because He knew exactly what the claim would be. You're just quoting from the scriptures, they don't have the authority of the law. Well, if the law, the first five books of the Bible, are in fact the Word of God, by the claim of Jesus, I'm just taking the Gospels as being reliable history, then He says the scriptures cannot be broken, then that would include the whole Old Testament can be classified as the Word of God, and then we can go and deal with the New Testament. So I think that there's a, you know, then we give textual criticism and all the rest of it. I think we build a strong argument for our being able to epistemic rights to claim I have a word from God, and that's why I should believe it.
Well, the statement that the Bible is a collection of books in the library produced in different times and in different places, of course, does not speak against it at all. That's just a fact about this collection of books. Then we need to read the books to see Is there a coherent story? Do we have reasons to believe that those many different books have ultimately a source within the mind of God? So then you have to go into the claims of the different books. Mm. And of course, we would like to point out the whole line of prophecy, God claiming something will happen. Mm. One day we'll do this, and the prophecies become more and more detailed and concrete. Mm. And you can see the fulfillment in Jesus Christ. So then suddenly what was presented here as an argument against the Bible actually becomes an argument for the Bible. Mm. A number of books produced in different places during different times present a coherent picture with prophecies that in the end are fulfilled in one person, in Jesus Christ. That cannot be a coincidence. So it seems to be something more with these books. There is something behind them.
Here's a real left field question. So you can volunteer if you want to answer. Why was it wrong of David to count the people of Israel? Remember the two accounts in the Old Testament where David carries out a census of the fighting men, and then is judged for it and gets to choose between three different punishments. Why was it wrong for David to count?
Yeah, so the issue arises because, as you say, there are different occasions where the same action is taken, but God seems to take a different moral view. So it's not the action that is the basis of the judgment. It must be something else about the situation that distinguishes them and means that God's right to judge one and not the other. So then we can theorize what that different thing is, and one might, for example, theorize that it is the motive in taking that action. So perhaps it is a motive of being aggrandized with one's own power as a nation and our ability to defend ourselves, and thinking, maybe I can trot up, if I've got enough power, I can work out if we can go and defeat so and so or protect ourselves from so and so, rather than relying upon God. So maybe it's something along those lines. But there's certainly no necessary contradiction between the two, because there's clearly more at play in moral situations than simply the action that is taken. There is also, for example, the motivation behind the action.
Now, the speaker said this morning that the doctrines we ignore today will be rejected tomorrow. Do you think there are such doctrines today churches ignore, and that we need to be stressing again in case we risk having forgotten tomorrow and diluted the
gospel? Well, it sounds good, but I'm not sure that we can make that as a claim. It may be a possibility, but it sounds too close to a slippery slope argument to me. But I think a good warning in it, if we don't take it as an absolute, then I think it serves as a very good warning to us that those things that we ignore today will be rejected tomorrow. But I'm not sure there's a clear-cut causal relationship between us.
Okay, a question again on ethics. And we know that the charge of the new atheism is not just against the historicity of the Bible, against the character of God, but also these charges that Christians are being arbitrary in what they choose to emphasize. Mm. Certainly, we find one of the big issues now is around sexuality, particularly homosexuality. Mm. And often the question is put a bit like this, so why are you eating seafood, as many of you did lunch today? Why are you eating prawns? Or why are you wearing clothing made up of different fibres? Aren't you just cherry picking, choosing the commands that you like out of the Bible? and disregarding the ones you don't. And often the question behind this is, why are Christians so hard about sex?
Mm.
And there's so many other things in the Bible that they seem to ignore. You'd like to
take
that. Let's see, the microphone's going to immediately up. Then,
it's an unfair accusation and a very strange use and reference of the Bible. If you take the food laws in the Old Testament, of course, we as Christians, we continue to read it in the Bible, and we know that all food is declared clean. So there has happened things. When we talk about sexuality, it is not anchored in the law of Moses, but it's anchored in creation. And the design God has given to his own world. And it is acted how it was from the beginning. And then it is confirmed right through the Bible, of course, in the law of Moses, but also from the mouth of Jesus, the one who declared all food clean, and from the apostles, who also said that the food laws had had in place. And they do not apply anymore. But in terms of sexual ethics, they confirm the creation story and the basic sexual ethic of the Old Testament. So I think, yeah, of course, there are things that are confused. Some people would like to point out that in Leviticus, the same word is abomination in English. It's used in connection to, for example, homosexual action and certain food. But they also forget that even though one word is connected, the punishment is totally different. So it's capital punishment for breaking God's sexual ideal, but it's not for food laws. So there's also a difference on that specific level. But basically, this is all about what is happening.
This is certainly a big question that comes up on university campuses and on the media.
Mm.
This whole question about sexuality, because often the new atheist worldview is closely aligned to the secular humanist ethic, which would hold that the only things really important when it comes to sex are desire and consent. In other words, if you feel attraction and there's consent, then it's okay.
Mm.
And that Christians have introduced a whole lot of repressive add-ons which stop human beings from flourishing fully. So I guess this is the question. We talked about origins earlier on, mm. and the fact that Christian beings hold different views, ranging all the way from six-day creationism to the new atheism. One of the big challenges facing us today is that also true of sex and sexual ethics, or is that in a different kind of category? And I think particularly at a time when many people in the churches are saying that there are a range of views that are acceptable and compatible with the Christian profession.
Mm.
I'd like to tackle that.
Mm.
In terms of contemporary culture, they say desire and consent, and people have thought a little bit more about it, would add adults to exclude sexual children. And I think that here we have sufficient criteria for how to navigate in terms of sexual issues. So adults, consent, and desire. But if you start to think about it, it's really insufficient. So, what about a man who's going to prostitute? Yeah, maybe there's not a mutual sexual desire, but there's a desire for money and desire for sex, and it's two adults and they're consenting. What about, which has been a case in Norway, a grown-up daughter having a child with her father, and they both say, we are consenting adults and we love each other. And you could come up with a huge number of situations where this does not seem to be sufficient. I'm not against those three criteria, but there seems to be things lacking for a healthy view on sex. So I think the problem here is on the side of our society, which are blind for the insufficiency of the current sexual ethics. I had a pre-formed seminar here on sex, and I went through the statistics in Sweden. What are the results of the sexual revolution? Yeah, you can say there's a lot of pleasure, and I'm not denying that, but there is immense pain for people following from the way we're living today. And I would say, even from a utilitarian, secular perspective, we are on the wrong way. And even more so if you bring in God and other parameters to this, but even from a utilitarian perspective, we are destroying ourselves today with our way of living sexually.
Well, I'm afraid that's all we've got time for, folks. But thank you very much for coming. But I just ask, as you go out, you will all have been given an assessment form. And if you could fill that in and leave that at the door as you go, that would be really helpful for the organisers and planning events in the future. Thanks very much for coming. I'm sure that our panellists will be willing to be called afterwards if there's any pressing questions that we feel weren't asked.